Two-time Peabody Award-winning writer and producer Ira Rosen reveals the intimate, untold secrets and stories of his decades at America's most iconic news show, 60 Minutes. His new book is Ticking Clock, Behind the Scenes at 60 Minutes. When Ira Rosen walked into the offices of the show in June of 1980, he knew he was about to enter television history. His career catapulted him to the heights of TV journalism, breaking some of the most important stories in TV news. But behind the scenes was a war room of clashing producers, anchors, and the most formidable 60 Minutes figure, legendary correspondent Mike Wallace, who Rosen worked with. Based on decades of access and experience, Rosen takes us behind closed doors to offer an incisive look at the show that invented TV investigative journalism. It is a great pleasure to welcome Ira Rosen to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. What a great pleasure to have you on the program.
Hey, no, thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
I feel like this book is it's a gift to all of us, and certainly if you're a fan of 60 Minutes, but it's a real gift to journalists, too, because it's a fascinating behind-the-scenes story, and I just adored reading this book. Let us begin with the very funny story of how you got the job at 60 Minutes, which weirdly involves a call to your mother.
Yeah, and it's I had been bouncing around in various newspaper jobs. I started right after Watergate when everybody wanted to be a reporter, and I had 98 rejections out of 100 letters I had sent. And so now I'm 26 years old. I'm working at a local New York station that people didn't even know had a news division, WOR-TV in New York. And I'm an on-air reporter. And I did a pretty good story. The phone rang, and my mom answered, and she said, hello, who is this? Oh, it's Don Hewitt. And what are you doing? Oh, I'm making a kugel. Oh, I haven't had a good kugel in a long time. So they're having a whole conversation. I'm kind of tuning it out. And then Don says, listen, I'd like to see if your son would be interested in being a producer on 60 Minutes. And my mother said, no, thank you. He's got a good job already. Thanks anyway. And I sort of heard the tail end of that. And then I get on and I said, Mom, who is that? And he said, oh, it's Don Hewitt. He wanted to offer you a job, but you have a job already. How many jobs do you need? So immediately I called Don back and he said, hey, you know what? I don't know about you, but I like your mother. So if she doesn't want the job, tell her it's hers. So needless to say, I wanted the job. And I went in the next day and I saw Don. And, you know, Don and I had a kind of an instant rapport with each other. You know, he's kind of a, you know, Jewish kid from New York, likes to kibitz and likes to have a good time. And but he said, it doesn't really matter what I think. He has to like you. And the he was Mike Wallace.
He was doing what?
With you.
Why?
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 Really?
When you boil it down to low gravy,
you demanded special treatment.
You needed money.
It's almost an embarrassment, sir, to hear this from you.
What?
What do they want you to do?
What is it?
And so he kind of walks me down the hallway. And I go into Wallace's office, and there was a tennis ball that I noticed there, and I didn't say anything about it for a moment. And Mike says to me, I know what I can do for you. What can you do for me? And it was a great question. I didn't really have a good answer. And I said, well, I was on the Cornell tennis team. And he told me that he figured that if it didn't work out as a producer, he could get 6 months of tennis out of me before firing me. So that's how I got my beginning.
Obviously, you walk in 1980, and the guy is already a legend, right? I mean, he is at arguably the height of his popularity, and he is breaking stories. He has a reputation. So how much of what you then saw and witnessed firsthand was a surprise to you?
Oh, you're talking about in terms of the way he behaved, and
well, just
or
your
the way
working,
he acted.
Yeah, your working relationship with him.
Yeah, I mean, I knew he was a tough guy, but I really had no idea. I mean, Mike's genius was looking at a total stranger and knowing exactly what button to push to drive them crazy. Well, it turns out he did that to his producers. So we would be on the road, and we would be doing a story. I was doing a story early in the year. One of my first stories was on school violence in L.A. And the first interview didn't go very well. And he's ripping my briefcase apart and throwing papers at me. And I said, the next one's going to be fine. And then we go to the next one. And sure enough, it's not fine. He's getting really angry. And I said, oh, I'm going to have to get a new job. So I bummed a cigarette from one of the cameramen. I go outside and a bunch of kids were there. And I said, how many kids here have gotten stabbed in school? So three hands were raised. How many kids did the stabbing? One hand raised. And now Mike comes out of this interview. He's like looking to fire me on the spot. And I said, interview the kids, ask them who got stabbed in school, who did the stabbing, and follow your instincts. And sure enough, he does that. And he gets to the kid who did the stabbing. And he says, you know, you took a knife, you put it in someone's belly, you twisted it around. How old are you? And kid says, 16 years old. You're nothing but a punk. And it was great. It was great TV. And, you know, classic Mike Wallace moment. And we get back in the car. We're staying in L.A. in the Beverly Hills Hotel. We're driving up the hill there. And he doesn't say anything for about a minute. And he turns to me and said, you know, you saved your ass tonight. I said, I know. And that was our entire conversation. That was my first test of reporting.
I asked the question because you write in the book, you say, I was trapped with Wallace. How much did you feel that you were trapped with him?
Oh, I tried to go work with Diane Sawyer. And I wanted to get away because, you know, he was so, you know, he was so, you know, he was so abusive. And, you know, each one of the producers who worked with Wallace had a different medical condition. It was like a MASH unit. So I had a bad back. I developed a bad back working with him. Another one had lost most of his hair. Another one had ulcers that he actually nicknamed Myron, which was Mike's real name. He called his ulcers Myron. Another one had developed skin cancer. He brought this extraordinary tension. Probably if I hadn't transferred and moved to Washington, I don't know if I would have survived working with him. But he didn't want to let me go. You know, he wanted to be the one to let a person go. He didn't want to have that person let him go. That was kind of the trap. And as much as I wanted to go work at the time with Diane, you know, he wasn't letting me.
Right. I want to get to, in a minute, you're leaving the show for a while and then coming back. But you describe something which I find fascinating, which obviously this is a long time ago where this could happen. It certainly can happen now, where you as a producer would do something, your research method you called airport roulette. Give listeners a sense of what that was, of basically a credit card in your pocket, travel the world and find what you can find.
Yeah, it was 1980 and it was pre-internet days. And the way we used to find stories is really reading the New York Times and the New York papers. And sometimes we would get newspapers from around the country 3 days late that would pile up on the couch. And so the only way to get a jump, and we were all very competitive, you know, we had something called a blue sheet system, where it's like a quick claim deed on a story. And so the way you get a jump on somebody else is to have the story first. So what I used to do is when I was struggling to find a story, I'd do something called airport roulette, where I'd go to the airport, throw my credit card down, say next flight out. And if the next flight is going to Akron and the flight after is going to Vegas, sorry, buddy, you're going to Akron. And so you because it's part of the karma of the chase. And so you go to Akron and you get all the newspapers and see if there's something interesting. And if there is, you stay and you make some phone calls, you work it. And if it's not, you get back in the car and you do it all over again. You get back in the plane and you go do it all over again. And you bounce around literally airport to airport for, you know, sometimes days. And, you know, you land, you grab the papers, you look, nothing's going on. You get back on another airplane. And we had an unlimited budget, so this was not a, you know, a hard thing to do. But usually after about 3 days of doing that, you know, I'd find a story or two that would be really great to do.
Ira Rosen is our guest. The name of the new book is Ticking Clock, Behind the Scenes at 60 Minutes. When do you think in your time there did things really start to click between you and Wallace? and that you feel you were doing some of your best work?
Well, I think it probably was. I did a story on Richard Miller, who was a FBI agent who had an affair with a Russian spy, this woman, Svetlana. And, you know, he became the first FBI agent who ever worked for Russia. This is, before Hansen. And I was in L.A. and I met his attorneys, and they actually said their defense was they wanted to make him look like an idiot, which is why they allowed him to go on 60 Minutes with Mike Wallace. And then after he agreed to go on camera, we interviewed the KGB agent, Svetlana, up in Terminal Island. And it was one of those stories that just come together. And I write in my book, Ticking Clock, that Mike was at the height of his powers, but so was I. You know, we were both at the top of our games. Mike was a brilliant interviewer. I was figuring out the producer game. And that story ended up leading the season. And, it was right before I went off to Harvard on a Nieman Fellowship. Everything worked out on that story. It never happens. When I screened it for Don Hewitt that day, I still remember it as if it happened yesterday. Don, at the end of the screening, came charging out, and I thought he was going to throw a punch at me. Instead, he put a finger in my face and he said, "Don't you ever show me this piece again, because if you do, I may do something stupid and make a change in it." And that's like the height of a compliment that you could ask for.
You write in the book that the verbal harassment I experienced from Mike Wallace and other TV big shots was, in a word, criminal. And that doesn't even get into the sexual harassment that the women in the office had to deal with. I guess this is a question that is being asked and has been asked for several years now, openly, much more openly, about how an environment like that exists for so long, and especially on one of the most admired television programs in the history of television.
Well, it was kind of a crazy madman culture. There's no excuses for it. It was wrong, but I don't think anybody blew the whistle on it at the time. People were too busy either making a career. I've talked to a number of the women on the show about it as well. And, you know, I talked to one woman who Mike, literally he grabbed her ass, and she turned around and smacked him and said, "Don't you ever do that again." And he said, "What the hell is her problem?" That was his answer, his reply. Yeah. And, and she said, "Listen, I was doing great stories at the time." It was doubly hard for them, because not only did you have to do the great stories, but you had to put up with that completely obnoxious abuse and behavior. And she kind of gutted it out, and she did some extraordinary stories, and she just made a choice at that point. Later on, obviously, people became aware of all this stuff, and that behavior was never tolerated. But during that period of time, Mike Wallace got away with murder,
and Don Hewitt too, right?
Yeah, but I've read about the Don thing. I only wrote in the book about what I saw. I mean, that's sort of, what you do as a journalist. You don't, want to pass on hearsay stuff. But Don, from everything I've heard and everything I've spoken to, is also, I mean, maybe not of the level as Mike, but he was involved in some of that behavior as well, from what I've read.
When you look at the cover of your book, Ticking Clock, there is the iconic stopwatch, and the glass on the watch, the crystal, is broken. To give you an idea that the show in some way is broken. And while the culture certainly was extremely broken, we as an audience never really saw that, ever, have we?
Well, not really. And I think the graphic of the book jacket was done by, a graphic department. And it's kind of to catch your eye. And I'm not implying that the show is broken. I think the show's been on the air for now 53 years. It's different, certainly, from the way it was when I was there. Back when I was there, it was more, you were doing more storytelling. You were doing, you know, adventures of, you know, Morley would go on the Orient Express, the last ride, or Harry Reasoner would do the story about Casablanca movie set. You know, Mike would chase Medicare fraud artists down the road. The story now is a little bit more current. I'm doing stories more in the pandemic, politics, that area. And it's evolved. It's changed. It's by no means is it broken. I just think it's changed a lot. And as far as the cover goes, you know, that's the publisher's prerogative to make a cover like that.
They, you, of course, worked with Mike Wallace, and you did work with other correspondents. And I want to get to the good times here of some of the good working relationships that you had. But before we do that, let us talk about some of the other issues that you had. One being Steve Croft, who was with the program for a long time, but difficult to work for or with.
Oh, yeah. 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 No, he was, you know, an extraordinary magazine correspondent. A fantastic writer. We did a story on John Gotti Jr., the mafia guy. And, you know, he was talking about John Gotti Sr., who was probably the most notorious gangster New York had ever known. And he said about John Gotti Sr., he wanted everybody to know what he did as long as they couldn't prove it, which is just an amazing line. I remember when he wrote it, and I grabbed him and I said, we're going to straight to the tracking booth before you change it. But, you know, Steve also was very, very tough on his producers. You know, he had the sense that, you know, 60 Minutes is a collaboration, and you have to honor the work of the producers. You know, you're a team. Think of it as almost, in a weird way, it's like a tennis doubles team. You know, maybe one player is better than the other, but you're not going to win unless you play together. And Steve, you know, he was very insecure about the role of producers in the work. You know, I think that was, you know, to his detriment, I think. I don't think it helped. Because, you know, we were the ones out there, you know, frankly, finding stories that'll make them look good.
The other correspondent that you worked with that was troublesome was Katie Couric, and which is interesting because of her reputation as, you know, the Miss Nice of television. So what was the issue there? You write about her interview with Sully Sullenberger. You write about other interviews that you worked with her on. What was at the heart of that issue?
I actually only did one story with her on Hillary Clinton's bid to be president in 2012, and later on I did 2016 with other people. So, I mean, the issue at that point was, you know, I felt she was disengaged from the process. You know, the story needed some work. I needed to, you know, like I was telling you before, it's a team concept. And I think in that time, frankly, you know, we just didn't click. I mean, sometimes it's as simple as that. It's unfortunate because I think Katie would have been a great addition ultimately had she worked out for 60 Minutes. And, you know, she was anchor, I think, about 5 years on the evening news and then left.
What does it say about what it takes to have longevity at the program?
Boy, good question. I think a strong stomach. I think you need to, frankly, have the ability to tell a good story. You know, you have to know how to tell a story. You have to know how to find a story. You have to know how to put a story together. I'm talking from the perspective of a producer. And then there's the correspondence. I mean, the one who I was lucky enough to work with at the very end was Bill Whitaker. And he's amazing, amazing correspondent. He's a great interviewer. He's in the trenches with you. If things are not going right, he's in there editing these stories with you. Another one was Bob Simon, who unfortunately died in a car accident. Mm. Another person who would be in the edit room with you and working away. Anderson Cooper, who everyone knows from his work on CNN, but is also he has a photographic memory for questions. You give him 25 questions and he'll remember every one of them. And he just sits down and he does his interview. And then at the very end of it, he kind of looks to see if he missed any of them. And he also understands the role of the producers, very appreciative of them. And of course, Leslie Stahl. Leslie Stahl's extraordinary interviewer. But the thing I wrote about in my book, Ticking Clock, which was that I admire her more for the fact that she's a good family person. She has a husband that's ill. She makes sure she leaves work every day at 5 o'clock. If it means, working through lunches and just getting up early or whatever, she's going to be home with her husband at 5 o'clock and caring for him. And that's something that, all of us as producers kind of admired. And so aside from being a great journalist, she's like a good person.
Ira Rosen is the author of the new book, Ticking Clock, Behind the Scenes at 60 Minutes. It is published by St. Martin's Press.
The story will continue in a moment.
Ira Rosen is our guest on the roundtable this morning. The new book is Ticking Clock, Behind the Scenes at 60 Minutes. It is published by St. Martin's Press. While we're talking about Leslie Stahl, how did you react to the story last year when Donald Trump got up and walked out of the interview with Leslie Stahl?
I didn't want to have this kind of angry.
Of course you did.
No, I didn't.
Of course you did.
No, I didn't.
Well, then you brought up a lot of subjects that
were inappropriately
brought up.
Well, I said I'm going to ask you tough questions.
They were inappropriately brought up right from the beginning. No, your first question was, this is going to be tough questions.
Why?
You don't ask Joe Biden. I saw your interview with Joe, the interview with Joe Biden.
I never did a Joe Biden interview.
It was a joke. The interview, 60 Minutes. I see Joe Biden giving softball after softball. I've seen all of his interviews. He's never been asked a question that's hard.
Okay, but forget him for a minute.
No, but you start with me.
You're president. And
excuse me, Leslie, you started with me. Your first statement was, are you ready for tough questions?
Are you?
That's no way to talk. It's no way to talk.
Leslie, one second.
At this point, one of our producers interrupted to advise about the time remaining in the interview.
I think we have enough of an interview here, Hope. Okay, that's enough. Let's go. Let's go. Let's go meet for 2 seconds, okay? Thanks. I'll see you in a little while. Thanks.
It's funny. I think he was obviously on edge when he did that, because I don't think anything that Leslie did in that particular interview was untoward. She said, she was trying to, at the beginning of the interview say, this, I'm going to ask some tough questions, but that's Leslie's style. And, I don't think that she did anything wrong. I just think he kind of was very on edge. It was really the first interview, I think, in many that he had done that was a little bit confrontational, because normally at that point in time, he was doing a lot of friendly interviews. And this one was, challenging him a bit. And either he wasn't ready for it, or he kind of, maybe in my, this is my opinion, I think he might have overreacted.
You write in the book about when Don Hewitt, he passes and leaves, and then in comes Jeff Ager, who is overseeing this and taking over a show just as the correspondents, all of the original correspondents, as you say, are past retirement age. It's an aging team. And so what was the job for him, and how much of a balancing act is that to keep the stars, to keep the people that we all know and love and have been in our living rooms for decades, as well as to look with an eye to the future of the show?
Yeah, it's the hardest thing in the world, because think of it like running a baseball team where you have, Mickey Mantle. I'm a Yankee fan, so you have Mickey Mantle and Roger Maris and all these people who are you know, who are stars, and, you know, in the old days it was Whitey Ford, and suddenly you have to replace all these people. And so in those times, you know, we had, you know, all within a few years, we had Mike Wallace and Bob Simon and Ed Bradley, all dying, Andy Rooney. So, you know, how do you replace them? Who can replace them? They have to be replaced. Somebody's got to play left field, as they say. But you try to find the very, very best people. I think the executive producer at the time, who succeeded Don, Jeff Fager, found Bill Whitaker, who's been an extraordinary addition to the broadcast. You know, he stepped in very nicely for some of those who had departed.
Speaking of departed, when you first left the show, what led to that decision to say, okay, it's time for me to look for something else?
Well, I had kind of had enough of Mike at that point. I had, you know, I had been given this opportunity to work at ABC to help start a new show. It was kind of exercising a different set of muscles. And I was going to be a senior producer on Primetime Live that Diane Sawyer and Sam Donaldson were going to host. So now it's my chance to finally work with Diane. And it was a new challenge. And when I went over to ABC, I basically said, you know, the hidden 60 Minutes used to be one of the pioneers of the use of hidden cameras. And I said, you know, the cameras are getting smaller and smaller, and we could bring them into places that had never existed before. So why don't we use, you know, the hidden cameras to sort of be a signature of our investigative stories? And basically, Phyllis McGrady, the executive producer at the time, said, okay, when can you start? And it was one of those situations. And it was a great challenge. It was interesting. And the irony of it all was I was going from working with Mike Wallace to working with his son, Chris Wallace.
And there's a great difference, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, Chris is very, you know, I mean, people have seen him now in a couple of presidential debates, and they see him every Sunday. He's incredibly smart, incredibly focused. And interestingly enough, he never once asked me, when we worked together, what would my father do, you know, on any interview or anything like that. He always wanted to carve his own kind of signature style. And he would have succeeded had his last name been Smith instead of Wallace. I mean, he was that talented and smart. He also had some roughness around the edges and got producers angry, you know, in his way. But you know, he wasn't anywhere as extensively hard on the producers as his father was.
You tell, I think, a telling story in the book about the relationship between Chris and Mike Wallace as it pertains to an interview with Chris Rock. And this is an interview that Chris Wallace was to do that ultimately would at one point be taken over by Mike Wallace. You intervened. Give us a sense of how that shows the relationship between these two men. A scene that really ultimately kept the two from talking to each other for well over a year.
Yeah, no, I mean, actually, at Mike Wallace's memorial service in New York, Chris actually told this story, this story as well, which was Chris was going to going to interview Chris Rock. And at the last minute, Chris Rock changed his mind to do Mike Wallace. Mike Wallace basically took the story away from Chris. And Chris Wallace told me this, and I immediately called Mike. And, you know, you got to remember, when we talk to each other, there's no hello, how are you? There's no warm-up. It's like you start immediately with a conversation. So I called Mike, and I said, why are you ripping your kid off? And he said, what are you talking about? And he said, you're taking Chris Rock away from him. Oh, he'll get over it. I said, Mike, here's the deal. You have a choice. Either Chris will speak at your funeral or you could do Chris Rock. You can't do both. So there was a pause at the end of the line. He said, let me get back to you. So 15 minutes later, he calls me back And he said, I solved the problem. I said, how? He said, I gave it to Bradley. I said, that's not solving the problem. You're still ripping your kid off. He said, what are you talking about? I'm not doing the story. And in his mind, because he wasn't doing the story, he was giving it to Bradley, frankly, because it was a make good, because he had ripped Bradley off on another story on Manuel Noriega. And so he gave it to Bradley. Bradley ended up doing Chris Rock. Chris Wallace never did him. And it was a huge fight between them that lasted for a long time. They eventually made up. But it gives you the sense that not only were they competitive among themselves, they were competitive in members of their own family.
So as we conclude our time together, let me ask you about one more story here. And that is the Trump years and ultimately the interview that you do with Steve Bannon. I was fascinated by this relationship that the two of you had, your conversations with Steve Bannon, and ultimately, and we'll get into this in a second, of what Steve Bannon told you about Trump, but your relationship with Steve Bannon that allowed the interview with then 60 Minutes correspondent Charlie Rose to happen in the first place.
How do you want to be perceived, you, today, because you have a media image?
The media image, I think, is pretty accurate. I'm a street fighter. That's what I am.
You're more than that.
No, I think I'm a street fighter. And by the way, I think that's why Donald Trump and I get along so well. Donald Trump's a fighter. Great counterpuncher. He's a fighter. I'm going to be his wingman outside for the entire time to protect.
So you'll not be attacking them. Donald Trump in your role.
No. Our purpose is to support Donald Trump. By the way,
and destroy his enemies.
To make sure his enemies know that there's no free shot on goal. By the way, after the Charlottesville situation, that's what I told General Kelly. I was the only guy that came out and tried to defend him. I was the only guy that said, he's talking about something, taking it up to a higher level. Where did this all go? Where does this end? Does it end in taking down the Washington Monument? Does it end in taking down?
I tell you where many people suggest it should have gone. It should have gone in terms of denouncing, specifically from the very beginning, neo-Nazis and white supremacists and people of that political view. And it should have gone there because those were people that Americans in World War II went to fight against. And you should have instantly have denounced them. And you didn't at first instinct. In fact, you seemed to be doubling down in terms of a moral equivalency.
What he was trying to say is that people that support the monument staying there peacefully and people that oppose that, that's the normal course of First Amendment.
I had gotten to know Steve through Peter Schweitzer, who had written the book Clinton Cash. And I was actually more interested in trying to get Roger Ailes, who was friendly with Steve Bannon. And so Steve and I got to know each other a little bit. And then one day I had heard through another person that Bannon was in line to be involved in the Trump campaign. And so we have breakfast, and he shows up wearing a kind of an army flak jacket, long beard, long hair, and he sits down and he says, I'm going to run the Trump campaign and for president. And there was so much wrong with this picture. He looked like he had just gotten out of a homeless shelter.
Yeah.
And now he's telling me he's about to run a presidential campaign. And then sure enough, he did. And he got in the White House. He became senior presidential advisor. And then for the next, few months, we would communicate on a daily basis. And then on weekends, what I do, I would fly down to Washington and hang out with him either in the West Wing or I would go to his house and basically, take a download from him. And at the time I was gathering information. It's kind of like a squirrel who's, putting the nuts together, but not eating them until winter, knowing that, we're building towards the moment when he'd go on camera. And that's what a producer does. You develop, trust, you develop the information, and for the moment when he will reveal. And it became, when he decided to do it, there was a lot of pressure on him not to do it. But we had just communicated for a long time, and he said, no, I'm going to do it with Ira, and I'm going to do it with 60. And it became one of the great classic interviews of 60 Minutes.
It was an incredible story, as you say, two parts. Charlie Rose does it. It ultimately becomes Charlie Rose's last story that airs on 60 Minutes.
One of his last stories, one of his last. Certainly his last major story, but
The point where you say in your relationship after years of sitting down with him, does he know that the ultimate ask is coming, that we want you to be on 60 Minutes?
Oh, totally. I would be talking about it almost every time we met. There's no surprises there. And he would say either the time is not right or whatever. When Trump fired him, then things moved very quickly to him doing it.
You write in the book, one of the headlines to come out of the book is that Bannon had a campaign to have Trump removed from office because he believed the former president had dementia. When did he bring that up to you?
Oh, he brought it up to me during the various conversations. I wanted him to talk about it on camera. He was struggling, before going on camera. He was struggling about what he would end up saying. I actually joked with him right before we did the interview. I said, are you gonna kiss him or kill him? Talking about Trump. And he said, I haven't figured it out yet. And so I said, you better figure it out soon. We're going on TV, tomorrow. He literally was like that. He would go from totally supportive of the president, supporting of his ideas and his views, to hating everything about him. I sent him a David Brooks of the New York Times column talking about Republican senators who went to see him. So they went to see him, and they said, the column writes that they found Trump to be so repetitive they thought he was suffering from early Alzheimer's. And nevertheless, they gave him a standing ovation. It was one of my favorite columns. And I sent it to Steve, and he said, do the 25th Amendment. I never steer you wrong. That sort of thing. So, he was very engaged in this. But on the other hand, it's kind of like being with a boss. You have your good days and your bad days. And, when you're having your bad days, you want to leave and do whatever. But when you're having your good days, you say, oh, I'm having a good day. This job maybe isn't so bad. So that's kind of the way Steve was bouncing back then.
You put this amazing story in the hands of Charlie Rose, who you say was, obviously a brilliant interviewer. And one of the things he says right off the bat is, you will not be attacking Donald Trump. So he decides to go that way.
Yes.
And Rose quickly counterpunches, but you will destroy his enemies. That's still what we're seeing today, right?
Yeah. Bannon has gone through a lot of different changes and metamorphoses. He's a strange dude. Now he's been on an anti-Chinese rant. He was a big source of Michael Wolff's book that came out, where he said that the behavior of the Trump children was treasonous. Trump came out and said, not only did he lose his job, he's lost his mind. But then you look at what happened last month, and Trump gives him a pardon. So, he's been all over the place. I can't even follow sometimes, what Steve is into or not into. But he's an extraordinarily interesting character. And I don't think people have heard the last of him.
As time was going with Charlie Rose and Me Too, you actually get caught up in this story, and it's the New York Times, right? That they include your name in a paragraph that was included in the leak, in which you said, quote, encourage women to use their sex appeal to secure information from sources. This was from a lecture that you gave in 2012 at the Investigative Reporters and Editors Conference. So your thoughts on that, and ultimately how it came to put you in the direction of saying, okay, I'm ready to go?
Well, I had given a lecture. It wasn't sex appeal, it was flirt, that it was okay to, as part of the lecture, I said flirting is a tool in a journalist's toolbox in order to get information. And, you know, what I was trying to do is I was going through a series of ways of call somebody up when you don't call somebody up when you just want something from them. Sometimes tell a joke to a person so they don't dread your call. And I'm going through a whole series of these things. That would not be a word I would use today. I was being probably a little bit too glib. I would probably use the word charm, try to be charming. I think we all grow and we all learn and we all change. So anyway, that's sort of how that evolved. And then and by the way, that was a lecture to men and to women. It wasn't just to one. And so, that I ended up becoming, if you will, a kind of a small footnote to all this stuff at that point.
And then the decision that went into say, I mean, you write at the end, you know, there's no such thing as a happy ending, but you say, okay, look, it's time to go.
Yeah, I had just finished doing a story on the opiate epidemic, in collaboration with the Washington Post. And it was, an extraordinary bit of business because what we did was we showed how the Congress neutered the DEA at the height of their powers and took away their enforcement abilities. And the story focused on one guy, Congressman Dan Marino, who had kind of led the legislative change. Well, it turned out that Dan Marino was just named to be President Trump's new drug czar. So literally 2 days after doing that story, he was removed from power. And, he was removed from that position. And the story had enormous impact and enormous satisfaction in calling attention to the growth of the opiate epidemic and basically how members of Congress and their staff would make legislative changes that helped the drug industry. And then they'd go work for the drug industry after doing favorable legislation. It was, classic revolving door. The story would end up winning more awards than any story in the history of 60 Minutes. And I thought at the end, this is kind of a good way to go out. I was of age, it was just the right time. Everything felt right. You don't want to go out on your worst story. You want to go out on your best story. And by the way, this is not when I say, it's kind of when people retire from the military at the age of 50 or something. It's not like they're just going to go, many of them are not just going to go live on a beach. I'm going to do other things and have other things planned.
And the latest being this book. It is Ticking Clock, Behind the Scenes at 60 Minutes. It's published by St. Martin's Press. Ira Rosen, a great pleasure to speak with you. Thank you very much for sharing with us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much. Again, Ira Rosen is the author of the new book, Ticking Clock, Behind the Scenes at 60 Minutes. It is published by St. Martin's Press. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.